Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. Hello again, listeners. I'm glad you could join me for what feels like the 85th week of the pandemic. We've got a great show for you, filled with a bunch of interesting cases, including a great victory out of the 11th Circuit on jurisdiction to review USCIS denials, strange and complicated CIMT holdings, 212H waivers, and even a case about whether a 2-year-old was inspected and admitted into the United States 30 years ago. Standard medley of immigration chaos. Now, on to the first case. The first case this week is Canal A Media Holding LLC et al. V. USCIS, published by the 11th Circuit on July 8, 2020. This case is all about district court jurisdiction to review USCIS's denial of an I-129 petition and applications for L-1 non-immigrant status. In simple terms, it's about whether a company can sue USCIS for USCIS's denial of the company's immigration petition for one of its executives. And it's a great case. In fact, the law firm at which I'm a partner, Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, represented the victorious plaintiffs in this case, and the case was argued before the 11th by Ed Ramos, my fellow partner. The decision was issued in record time. Oral argument was only last month. And I've got Ed with me right now, virtually, to talk about it. What's the case about, Ed?
Thanks, Kevin. This was an appeal from a district court case that we had on behalf of a company that was seeking a visa, an L visa, on behalf of one of its workers. And the district court had held that the plaintiffs couldn't bring a suit in district court, that they could obtain review of the visa petition denial only through a petition for review of a final removal order because the beneficiary of the visa petition was in removal proceedings. And the 11th Circuit reversed the district court and it sent the case back to the district court, essentially holding that the proper place to file lawsuits challenging visa petition denials is in district court and not in the Court of Appeals off of a final removal order. And, you know, Kevin, I'll let you discuss the specifics of the case, but the one thing I'll say is that this was the rare case, I think, where the government really was the underdog, because the position they were taking in this case was completely the opposite of the settled understanding of where judicial review for these kinds of challenges belongs. The settled understanding has been, and this is kind of maybe one of your practice pointers, that when you have a decision by USCIS that can't be reviewed in the removal proceeding, and that maybe even involves different parties, like a visa petition, that those cases belong in district court in a challenge under the Administrative Procedure Act rather than through a petition for review. In some cases, you actually have to have parallel proceedings in federal court. And, you know, that's, I think, what the 11th Circuit recognizes, that that basically tracks the administrative process where you have two separate tracks. So I'll turn it over to you, Kevin, to discuss the specifics.
Awesome, Ed. Thanks for being on the podcast and congratulations again. Here are the facts. In this case, the first plaintiff, Canal Media, an international entertainment media company in Guatemala, has a subsidiary branch company in the U.S. In 2016, Canal sponsored its president, Mr. Archila, for L-1 non-immigrant status by filing a Form I-129 petition with USCIS. As required to get L-1 non-immigrant status, Mr. Archila was to be an executive or manager in the U.S. subsidiary branch of Canal Media. Mr. Archila was already in the U.S. on a tourist visa at the time, and after the petition was filed, DHS initiated removal proceedings against him. USCIS then denied the I-129 petition for Canal's alleged failure to establish its subsidiary relationship with its U.S. affiliate, as required for a beneficiary like Mr. Archila to obtain L-1A non-immigrant status. Canal filed suit in federal court under the APA, the INA, and the U.S. Constitution, with the assistance of our law firm. The U.S. government, through the Office of Immigration Litigation, or OIL, countered by moving the district court judge to dismiss the case for three reasons. OIL argued that denial of Canal's petition was not, quote, final agency action, because Mr. Archila was in removal proceedings before another agency, the immigration courts. Similarly, OIL argued that INA Sections 242B and Section G required that Mr. Archila bring any such claims in immigration court rather than federal court. Just saying OIL's position out loud is a bit absurd. After all, Canal Media is a corporation, and Canal, rather than Mr. Archila, is the petitioner, making Canal the aggrieved party, and Canal is not in removal proceedings. Plus, as immigration court practitioners know, immigration judges don't have authority to grant L non-immigrant status anyway. But the district court judge bought all of it and dismissed the case for lack of jurisdiction. The 11th Circuit disagreed, and it disagreed strongly. It held that all three of the district court judge's reasons for dismissing the case were wrong. First, addressing the final agency action finding. The court held that indeed, USCIS's denial of Canal's I-129 petition was final, regardless of whether Mr. Archila can succeed in immigration court on his separate claims. Remember, Canal, the aggrieved petitioner, is not a party to Mr. Archila's removal proceedings. The court then addressed the alternative statutory grounds used to dismiss the case. First, INA Section 242B9, also known as the Zipper Clause, bars review of claims arising from actions to remove non-citizens. But the 11th Circuit held, relying on long-standing 11th Circuit precedent and the Supreme Court's recent DACA decision, that the Zipper Clause bars review only of final orders of removal or decisions to remove non-citizens. It doesn't bar claims that are only tangential to removal proceedings, as was the case here. Turning to INA Section 242G, that provision is, quote, similarly narrow, and it applies, quote, to any cause or claim by or on behalf of any alien arising from the decision or action to commence proceedings, adjudicate cases, or execute removal orders. Again, not the case here. Canal was only challenging the denial of its petition. Congrats to Mr. Archila, Canal Media, Ira, Ed, John, Helena, and KKTP. What a great win. Canal Media gets its day in court. And as this entire decision is good stuff, here are just a few additional things from concurring Judge Newsom. First of all, and this is just amusing to me, Judge Newsom stated that he agreed with the majority court in full and wrote separately, quote, only to emphasize, what is to me anyway, the obvious correctness of the court's holding, end quote. He then concludes by summarizing the case quite nicely, quote, at 30,000 feet then, the government's position just can't be right. USCIS's rejection of Canal Media's I-129 petition is not final simply because a different agency that is housed in a different executive branch department and is vested with jurisdiction over different issues and is presiding over a different proceeding involving a different party hasn't finished its different business, end quote. Emphasis in the original. And that is Canal Media Holding LLC et al. The USCIS. Sticking a bit with jurisdiction, we've got Sharif v. Barr, out of the 8th Circuit on July 7th, 2020. This case is about change country condition motions to reopen, But really, it's about jurisdiction, to review factual findings following the Supreme Court's recent decisions Guerrero-Las Brias and Nasrallah. Mr. Sharif was admitted to the U.S. as a refugee from Somalia, adjusted to lawful permanent resident status, and was then convicted of 3 crimes. He conceded removability and did not apply for any relief, and so he was ordered removed to Somalia in 2008. But the U.S. government didn't try to remove him for many years, until 2017. DHS put Mr. Sharif on a plane, which due to a variety of issues, had to land in Senegal, where it remained for 24 hours before returning to the U.S. As an aside not mentioned in this case, the non-citizens on that flight were subjected to some pretty rough conditions, which led to litigation by Professor Rebecca Sharpless and the University of Miami, along with other lawyers working pro bono in the Southern District of Florida. Mr. Sharif then filed a motion to reopen his removal proceedings to apply for asylum and related relief based on changed country conditions in Somalia, likely a result of Professor Sharpless's litigation. The IJ and then the BIA denied the motion, finding that Mr. Sharif hadn't established a material change in conditions in Somalia since he was ordered removed in 2008. The Eighth Circuit dismissed Mr. Sharif's claims, largely for lack of jurisdiction, based on the criminal alien bar to reviewing factual challenges. The Eighth Circuit's jurisdiction finding, based on its interpretation of the Supreme Court's recent decision Guerrero-Las Brias, may create a circuit split on just what the Supreme Court meant in Guerrero. Indeed, as footnote 2 makes clear, this decision is already at odds with pre-Guerrero Ninth Circuit decisions. And that's good enough for me. Give me the circuit split gong. As to Mr. Sharif's Convention Against Torture claims in the motion to reopen, the Eighth Circuit was required to review them for abuse of discretion pursuant to the Supreme Court's recent decision in Nasrallah. But the Eighth Circuit held that no abuse of discretion occurred. It appears, though the court doesn't outright say it, that because Mr. Sharif didn't submit any evidence in 2008, remember, he just accepted a removal order, he can't meet his burden to show that reopening is warranted in 2018. If so, that's a very harsh interpretation of the changed country condition regulations. So, an unfortunate holding for circuit court jurisdiction. In fact, I think oil might post pages from this decision on the walls of its building. But there's some good stuff in it for jurisdiction as well. For example, the court states that notwithstanding the criminal alien bar to jurisdiction, it has, quote, jurisdiction to review pure questions of law, such as the definition of a statutory term, end quote. The Eighth Circuit also noted that Guerrero-Las Brias, quote, recently clarified that we have jurisdiction to review mixed questions of law and fact, including the proper application of a legal standard to undisputed or established facts, end quote. And with that standard in mind, the court provides a quote that could be used in the future to turn a factual claim into a legal one. Quote, Sharif does not assert that the facts as found by the BIA, taken on their own terms, are legally sufficient to constitute a change in country conditions that materially affects his eligibility for asylum or withholding of removal. Thus, Sharif's argument concerning changed country conditions is aimed directly at the agency's factual determinations, end quote. Put another way, had Mr. Sharif described his claims as legal rather than factual challenges, for example, arguing that the BIA applied the wrong legal standard to review what constitutes changed country conditions, he very well may have gotten over the jurisdictional bar. Finally, and for a bit of context, recall that Mr. Sharif did not challenge the removal order in 2008. Which largely destroyed his changed country condition motion to reopen a decade later. Although left unsaid, what probably happened in this case is that Mr. Sharif was detained in 2008, but knew that the U.S. government wasn't actually removing people to Somalia at the time, and he also probably knew that Supreme Court precedent prevents the U.S. government from detaining non-citizens for over 6 months after ordering them removed. So Mr. Sharif took an order of removal to get out of detention. Mr. Sharif is certainly responsible for the choices he made a decade ago, but this case also shows how detention is used as a method to pressure non-citizens into giving up fighting their case. And that is Sharif v. Barr. Next up is Killig v. Barr, published by the Sixth Circuit on July 10, 2020. This is a short case about INA Section 212H waivers and the torture convention. Ms. Killig is from Bosnia and Herzegovina and was a lawful permanent resident. She went to jail for conspiracy to commit armed robbery and was then found removable by an IJ for having been convicted of an aggravated felony, a conspiracy to commit a theft offense. Before the Sixth Circuit, she didn't challenge her removability, but rather asserted that the IJ should have granted her a Section 212H waiver of inadmissibility, and in the alternative, deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture. A bit of background is necessary here, as we've never discussed 212H waivers on the podcast. A 212H waiver waives a non-citizen's inadmissibility, but not her deportability. What's the difference, you ask? The grounds of inadmissibility are contained at Section 212 of the INA, while the grounds of deportability are contained at Section 237 and are generally more serious than the inadmissibility provisions. This makes sense because the Section 212 inadmissibility provisions are generally applied to non-citizens trying to come into the United States, while Section 237 deportability applies to non-citizens already here in the U.S., who the U.S. government is trying to remove. An LPR like Ms. Killick can only lose her LPR status if she is found deportable under Section 237, which is what happened here when the IJ found that Ms. Killick had been convicted of an aggravated felony. Ms. Killick asked for a 212H waiver to waive her deportability, but a 212H waiver only waives the inadmissibility provisions at Section 212. The only way an LPR like Ms. Killick can utilize a 212H waiver is if she again applies to adjust to LPR status, for instance, through a U.S. citizen spouse, relative, or sponsoring employer, or alternatively, if she left the United States and then came back with an immigrant visa, again through a U.S. citizen spouse, family member, or sponsoring employer. If she was eligible to readjust status or obtain an immigrant visa, she could use a 212H waiver to waive her inadmissibility at the time she readjusted or re-entered the U.S. But Ms. Killick is probably not eligible to readjust status or obtain an immigrant visa. So what she was trying to do was simply apply for a 212H waiver by itself to waive her deportability, and that you can't do. Her attorneys knew this, so they argued that this entire framework violates the Equal Protection Clause to the U.S. Constitution. The Sixth Circuit summarily rejected that argument. As to her Convention Against Torture application, the court held that it had jurisdiction to review the denial because of the Supreme Court decision in Nasrallah v. Barr, and then denied the challenge, holding that nothing about Bosnia's recent tragic history applies to Ms. Killick personally, and that although the evidence shows that sex workers in Bosnia are treated horrendously, Ms. Killick doesn't plan to be a sex worker. So, the Sixth Circuit denied the petition. And that is Killick v. Barr. Next up is Adi v. Barr, published by the Second Circuit on July 7, 2020. This case is primarily about inspections and admissions into the United States, and burdens of proof. Mr. Adi is approximately 30 years old and from Jamaica, and he was brought to the U.S. at the age of 2. In 2016, he was convicted of third-degree possession of stolen property in violation of New York Penal Code Section 165.50. And that same year, he married his longtime girlfriend, a U.S. citizen, who is also the mother of his 2 U.S. citizen children. Finally, in 2016, a big year for Mr. Odie, DHS initiated removal proceedings. DHS charged him as being present without being admitted or paroled, and as a non-citizen who has been convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude. Mr. Odey asserted that, in fact, he was inspected and admitted at the age of 2. This is important, because if he was inspected by an immigration officer at a port of entry and let into the U.S., even if the person was smuggling him and lied, and Mr. Odey didn't have proper documents to enter the U.S., Mr. Odey becomes an alien who has been inspected and admitted or paroled under immigration law, making him eligible to adjust to lawful permanent resident status through his U.S. citizen wife. On the other hand, if he was merely smuggled in and an immigration officer never saw him, he is not likely eligible to adjust status. Kind of arbitrary, I know. To show that he was inspected and admitted at 2 years old, Mr. Odey principally presented an immunization record and declaration from his parents, stating essentially that Mr. Odey's father had his girlfriend sneak Mr. Odey into the United States, presenting him as their own child with a photo-switched immigration document. Mr. Odey's mother provided a similar statement, and again, if true, this makes Mr. Odey eligible to adjust to LPR status. But DHS subpoenaed Mr. Odey's mother, leading Mr. Odey to withdraw her declaration, likely because his mother did not have lawful status in the U.S. and did not want to risk her own deportation by coming to immigration court. Mr. Odey's father is back in Jamaica, and he testified via telephone, but the connection was bad and the call dropped. DHS then showed that Mr. Odey's father had testified inconsistently. In total, the immigration judge held 3 evidentiary hearings, and Mr. Odey submitted as much evidence as he could to show that he was illegally smuggled and inspected and admitted into the U.S. 30 years ago. But the immigration judge ruled against Mr. Odey, and the BIA affirmed. Mr. Odey brought constitutional due process challenges before the Second Circuit. The court rejected them, noting that Mr. Odey had received several evidentiary hearings and continuances, and was allowed to present telephonic testimony. Mr. Odey also challenged the agency's separate finding that his third-degree possession of stolen property crime was a CIMT. Now, as Mr. Odey was already removable and ineligible for adjustment of status anyway, this CIMT finding wasn't so relevant, but the Second Circuit addressed it anyway. And it rejected his arguments, mainly because in 2000, the Second Circuit held that fifth-degree possession of stolen property was a CIMT, and Mr. Odey's conviction for third-degree possession of stolen property is materially identical. The Second Circuit also held that its 2018 decision Obaya v. Sessions and the Supreme Court's 2015 decision in Mullooly did not change its conclusion. So, Mr. Odey will have to depart the United States. Hopefully he can re-enter someday, perhaps with waivers, to be with his family. Not much good for non-citizens here. And that is Odey v. Barr. Our next case is Silva v. Barr, published by the Ninth Circuit on July 10, 2020. This case is about petty theft in California, CIMTs, and persecution in the Philippines. Mr. Silva is an LPR from the Philippines who was thrice convicted of petty theft in the early 2000s, in violation of California Penal Code 484A. An IJ and the BIA held that California Penal Code 484A is a CIMT, meaning that Mr. Silva was removable for having been convicted of 2 or more CIMTs. Mr. Silva appealed and also filed a motion to reopen with the BIA, claiming he now qualified for asylum because since his removal order, President Duterte of the Philippines has instituted an anti-drug program called Oplan Tokhang, translated as knock and plead, which focuses on drug users and sellers and has led to reports of extrajudicial killings. Mr. Silva claimed that his criminal history and history of drug use in both the U.S. and the Philippines would make him a prime target. The agency denied Mr. Silva's motion. The Ninth Circuit denied Mr. Silva's claims, too. First, it addressed the CIMT issue, and bear with me because it's a bit complicated. As we know, to determine whether a conviction is a CIMT, courts apply the categorical approach and compare the elements of the federal removal offense, a CIMT, with the elements of the state conviction, here California petty theft. If the state conviction criminalizes the same or less conduct than the federal offense, then we have a match, and the conviction makes the non-citizen removable. Historically, when it comes to theft-based CIMTs, if a state conviction criminalizes anything less than a permanent taking or an intent to permanently steal, the state conviction does not match the definition of a CIMT, because the CIMT definition required a permanent taking. Also remember, courts use the definition of the state offense used at the time of conviction, but they use the current definition of the removable offense. But with CIMTs, it's become a bit different, because in 2016, in matter of Diaz-Lizarraga, the BIA changed the definition of a CIMT to include less than permanent takings. And the Ninth Circuit, like all circuits so far, has held that the new CIMT definition does not apply to convictions obtained pre-2016. So in this case, we're not comparing the current definition of a CIMT to Mr. Silva's conviction, but rather the definition of a CIMT pre-2016, which again requires a permanent taking. If that wasn't confusing enough, the definition of California petty theft has changed over the years, and at the time of Mr. Silva's convictions, included mere temporary takings. So that should be the end of it. Mr. Silva's crimes do not match the applicable definition of a CIMT, because his crimes allowed for a temporary taking. But here's the kicker. The Ninth Circuit issued a bunch of decisions many years ago that didn't conduct the proper analysis and held that petty theft is a CIMT. And a panel of the Ninth Circuit is bound by prior Ninth Circuit precedent, even if the prior precedent is wrong, unless an intervening change of law from the Supreme Court or an en banc panel occurs. So even though the Ninth Circuit panel in this case believes that its decision is incorrect, it was required to hold that Mr. Silva has been convicted of two or more CIMTs and is removable. Wow. Turning to Mr. Silva's motion to apply for asylum, the Ninth Circuit agreed that Mr. Silva was merely speculating that someone in the Philippines would remember his drug use and tell the police, or that he'd use drugs again. And so Mr. Silva will be deported to the Philippines. Here's a little lemonade from those lemons. First of all, the Ninth Circuit includes some pretty strong dicta implying that it will defer to the new definition of a CIMT in matter of Diaz-Lizarraga. But the Ninth Circuit doesn't come out and say it in this decision. So respectfully, I believe that the issue of whether Diaz-Lizarraga is an appropriate change to the CIMT definition remains completely up in the air, including in the Ninth Circuit. Next, and this is pretty interesting, the majority says because the CIMT definition, quote, refers to a category of crimes rather than a specific offense with identifiable elements, the BIA has sensibly moved from trying to define the phrase itself to instead giving examples of the type of offenses that qualify as CIMTs, end quote. To me, this means that unless the BIA or a circuit has directly held that a crime is a CIMT, it's not. And if an IJ or the BIA says that a conviction is a CIMT simply because it matches the generic elements of a CIMT, the IJ and the BIA commit legal error, at least in the Ninth Circuit and at least under this decision. And finally, Judge Berzon concurred with the majority decision, but wrote separately to reiterate her view that the entire concept of a CIMT is unconstitutionally vague and should be struck from the INA. The Immigration Review Podcast is with you, Judge Berzon. And that is Silva v. Barr. Next up is Gordon v. Barr, out of the Fourth Circuit on July 8th, 2020. Longtime friends of the podcast are back, the realistic probability test and the antique firearm exception. And this case concerns a pure question of law. What does the realistic probability test require? Mr. Gordon was an LPR and was charged as removable under INA Section 237A2C, which makes removable LPRs convicted of a firearms offense. He was charged as removable based on his conviction under Virginia Code Section 18.2-280A for willful discharge of any firearm in a public place without resulting in bodily injury. Now, I actually talked about this case with my number one fan, Graham Malois, over the phone this morning. In this case, all parties agree that Mr. Gordon's Virginia conviction does not categorically match the federal definition of a firearms offense, because Virginia criminalizes discharge of any firearm, including an antique firearm, while the federal definition of a firearm offense, as we've discussed on the podcast, expressly excludes antique firearms. The IJ determined that because the Virginia statute applies to any firearm, including antique firearms, the Virginia statute is overbroad. And because the statute is not divisible, Mr. Gordon's crime does not match the removable firearm offense, and Mr. Gordon is not removable. The BIA, however, disagreed on appeal, and held that while the statute is overbroad on its face, the statute is only overbroad for removability purposes if Mr. Gordon can prove that there exists a realistic probability that Virginia actually criminalizes willful discharge of an antique firearm. Because Mr. Gordon could not do so, the BIA held that he was in fact removable. The Fourth Circuit, appropriately, held that the BIA misapplied the realistic probability test. Rather, because the plain text of the statute, supported by actions taken by Virginia's legislature, makes clear that Virginia criminalizes use of any firearm, including an antique firearm, that's the end of the story. The realistic probability test has no role to play. And because DHS has already deported Mr. Gordon, they now need to bring him back and give him back his green card. The Fourth Circuit's application of the realistic probability test in this case aligns with the majority of circuits, and perhaps all circuits, except the Fifth Circuit, and kind of the BIA, though in my opinion the BIA has yet to make up its mind. I hope the Supreme Court steps in soon and agrees with the Fourth Circuit and the majority of circuits. Great win. Here are a couple of notes. Another big win for Capital Area Immigrants' Rights Coalition, petitioner's attorneys on this case, and a name that listeners may remember from the decision out of D.C. District Court last week, striking down the Trump administration's third country transit rule. Keep kicking butt, CARE. Next, and unless I'm missing something, it would appear that all firearms offenses in Virginia no longer match INA Section 237A2C removability. Because presumably, Virginia does not exempt antique firearms from any of its firearm statutes. Moving on, here's a good quote from the Fourth Circuit to remember about the categorical approach, describing the Supreme Court's analysis in Mathis. Quote, as the court instructed, overbreath in the state statutory language under comparison may manifest itself either by omission, here by omitting an exclusion for antique weapons together with use of the word any, or by specifying additional means of commission, end quote. In other words, practitioners, the statutory text, including the text that state legislatures decided to omit, is often your best friend. And finally, the realistic probability test analysis in this case is in contrast, at least in part, with the BIA's 2014 decision in matter of Chayres. But remember, if the circuit court you practice in has held, like the Fourth Circuit did in this case, that the realistic probability test does not apply when the statutory text is clearly overbroad, you don't need a case directly on point to disregard matter of Chayres or similar BIA decisions. This is because the realistic probability test is a question of law in which the BIA has no special expertise, because it does not require an interpretation of the Immigration and Nationality Act. IJs are therefore bound by how circuit courts choose to apply the realistic probability test, not by how the BIA does. And that is Gordon v. Barr. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate for 5 credit hours, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook, at Immigration Review, and send us a tweet, at ImReview. That's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.